Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. I almost get that out correctly half the time. This was not one of those times. This episode is entitled The Dialectics of Falling. And, well, it's actually about a couple things. It's about many things. This podcast contains multitudes. It's about an exciting upcoming film premiere project, as well as some musical projects. One of the films called The Dialectics of Falling. The music thing is called, or I guess you call it an album. I guess that's what they call them these days. Music things album are called albums. The Semiotics of Semiotics Volume 1, The Kitchen Window. And our guest for this episode is someone who knows something about the two exciting projects and the multitudes they contain, Mr. Andrew Fox. Hi.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Good to be here. I'm glad you're here. Anything else you want to say for yourself before we dial ourselves in?
This is my first podcast.
This is your first podcast? This is you're a podcast virgin?
I am, yeah.
This is not how most podcasts go. I think this is you're having a weird first podcast experience.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've listened to them.
But the people have different setups, and like this is yeah,
right.
Yeah, you're not wearing headphones. You don't have your own mic. It's a big ugly mess that you've gotten yourself into. Actually,
it's super chill.
Good. I'm glad you're feeling that way. So what would we like to talk about first in terms of your creative projects, I guess? This is, if nothing else, the narcissistic pleasure of being interviewed for about an hour or so. Let's dive in!
So the film, The Dialectics of Falling, it's actually, there's a little bit of wordplay, and it's called The Dialectics of Falling... In or out of love. And it's basically a film that accompanies a poem that I've been working on for about 3 years. Like in its infancy, I was writing the poem from the perspective of a dumpster.
Okay.
And it just kind of grew from there, and I've just kind of been adding and editing over the last 3 years, trying to get it to feel right, and I think it finally does.
Is it still from the perspective of a dumpster?
It could be.
Well, dumpsters are sort of fascinating because they are the endpoint of a love in a consumer society, or at least are.
And so... How I get it still could be, and as you just said that, so like the end of love, but it can also be the beginning of love.
How so?
At the end of love, what one places in a dumpster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as cliche as it might be, the whole one's trash, another's treasure.
Absolutely.
You know, really, somebody else can come along and find that trash and think that it's beautiful. Yeah. You know, if that's a part of somebody, you know. And that, you know, that can lead to something else.
Yeah, and I think about, you know, is the morality in a consumer society being a good consumer? Right, is that you're supposed to acquire and move on. And I think about those of us, we're in this book, you were talking before I hit record about how many freaking books are in this room, and this isn't all the freaking books that are in this house. I guess I acquire and I don't move on. I just keep acquiring, which, it's not hoarding, there are no dead cats under any of this shit. That is my, after watching that for a season on A&E, because I had a thought about a research project, like is it a hoard or is it a collection? Are there dead cats there? You know, that's dead cats under, yes, hoard. No collection. We're good.
Right.
We're good over here. But you're supposed to move on. But then again, there's also, yeah, the rest of us who are broken consumers who don't want to participate, who, yeah, what if we don't care about new things? What if we do, you know, recycle? Those are broken people, aren't they?
I guess.
You know, but aren't we all a little broken? But yeah, I mean, so yeah, the dumpster, maybe that is the locus of our culture, is the dumpster.
Right. And, like, I guess where I was going with that originally was that we all kind of are dumpsters.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, for, like, in the way that we consume, like, especially as a broken people, as you were just saying, yeah, about people who take in and don't, you know, don't keep moving on.
Yeah.
You know? Taking everything in and, like, giving it a place and, like, you know, making it significant. Whereas, like, this can be just something that somebody else is throwing away.
Yeah.
You know?
Which, and so if you're talking about falling in and out of love, you know, I guess there's also then, is it an existential question? Do I ask too many existential questions on this podcast? But, you know, this question of can you ever fully stop loving someone, or what does it mean to, for when a relationship ends, when a period's over, or, you know, which is a sort of dialectical thing, right? Is that, you know, but really that's coming from weirdly, in a weird way, a place of love in a really broken, like, you had to have a feeling before you could have the feeling about someone.
Right. Do I believe that you can, like, what, you can never, like, not love?
Yeah, I mean, do you think that it is possible, you know, even if, you know, moving on, or you put that other person in the dumpster, and, you know, shared things from that era of one's life, you know, I had a friend who had a, you know, the relationship ended, and, you know, it was a cohabitating relationship ended, and then there was a storage unit involved, and a storage unit that, you know, rent got displaced or behind on, and then suddenly, you know, which was a weird thing, I think, because it was like, oh, well, I still want these things, or still have these things, or these things, but they're in a locked box somewhere, and then, you know, something happened and the, you know, locked box got repossessed or whatever, and so then all those things were gone, which was for them, I think it still is, I mean, I think, you know, its own kind of trauma. It's like, well, you didn't quite throw it away, but you kind of lost it,
right?
Which is a different experience too,
right?
You know, I think there's an agency question. And So tell me more about the film, though. Sorry, I got us in a tangent.
No, it's a tangent. It's great. The film, I shot it with my best friend of 20 years, which has been really great because we just kind of went down different paths. He was the first person that I ever played music with.
Oh, wow.
Like, in that way that it seems like every 12 or 13-year-old kid is like, yeah, I want to start a band, you know, but not all of them actually do it, you know. Some of them actually get as far as, like, getting instruments, but they never learn them.
Mm.
Like, I know so many people from, like, that age of my life where that was happening. Like,
yeah.
All these people got guitars and drums, but they never learned how to play them. But, like, we didn't have anything else, and that's what we did. And But yeah, we just kind of like reconnected doing this. He has become like a really good photographer over the last few years, focusing most, I mean, his main focus is like nature photography. He's kind of an adrenaline junkie. He likes to jump off things.
Oh, wow.
Like, explore a lot. And he just kind of captures all that through film. And we've just been talking about shooting a film together. And this project just kind of rose to the top above all the other ones. The project, oh man, I mean, obviously you're gonna edit this, right?
No, we just kind of grip it and rip it.
Oh god.
No, I mean, this is, you know, speaking of, see, if this was hard, I wouldn't do it.
Right.
And so editing, oh, you gotta do razor blade cuts and then fix stuff, you know. No, I slap some compression on there, intro music, outro music, and
right.
We're out.
Yeah, that's cool.
So whatever happens.
Happens.
Now, I did have somebody implicate someone in a crime once. And I did have somebody say something that would get them fired. And I did do razor blade edits of that. That I just took names of things out and then just put, I think, gobbling turkeys in the space.
Right.
Yeah, so.
But yeah, the film, it's not that, it's about 6 minutes long. Hmm. It's very brief. But I shot this film before for a submission to a Button Poetry video publication, and like I shot it all on my phone. I was like too nervous to ask anybody else to be a part of it to help me shoot it. So everything was all from like the perspective, just like the first person perspective, and there were some cool shots, but it was just really poorly, you know, done. Like the video quality was not good, and I'm not a videographer. I'm not good at that.
That's good, but you have some of you that is,
you know. So I took some of the ideas that I had in that video, incorporating like different pieces of graffiti that are around the East End of Pittsburgh that I feel like are really kind of inspiring. And there was actually another shot from the original film that I wasn't able to get exactly because this building had been boarded up by the time I got back to it, but wow. We were able to fly a drone above it.
It's drone action.
Yeah, there's drone footage in this film.
Awesome.
Yeah, so like it's a big step from just like a shitty, you know, probably not even mid-range smartphone to like professional video equipment.
Wow. And so then is there just a voiceover of the poem, or is there
It features yes, that is occurring. The poem is happening. I constructed some like just ambient guitar in the back. Very minimal. Actually, the effects are doing most of the work. And the film, at parts, you can see me performing the monologue. but it's very brief because I felt like that's not really the important part here.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is me kind of walking around.
Cool.
Which is something that I like to do, but I don't do enough. I like to just walk around and be mindful and just kind of experience the environment, you know, around me in a different way, you know, like just changing the average monotonous experience, because I'm also a person who is a creature of habit,
mm-hmm.
and wants order and wants to kind of do the same thing to feel comfortable. And it's like when I get that way, and that can be good, but that can also be very bad.
Yeah, I mean, it can be an enemy of creativity and experience. And, you know, that was the thing for me, was like part of why I started photo blogging was, you know, I would just kind of get lost in my own head or lost in other people's heads, you know, like, oh, what does Theodore Adorno think of hot dogs? I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, those would be thoughts, you know, oh, I'm hungry. What would Adorno think of hot dogs? Thing. You know what I mean? It just kind of mumble around and kind of forget that the world's happening. Right. And I guess, too, I mean, mindfulness is an important part of our moment, because we can also, we do have, thanks to the mid-range smartphone, the profound capacity, right, to just escape from reality whenever the fuck we want, whether we're imposing a soundtrack on it or whether we're just looking at that fucking screen, man.
Right.
You know, and that's a personality type. A few years ago, I made my students do a digital detox, and they're like, what if we can't do it? And I was like, well, then that's what you write about. You write about the failed experiment. You write about, you know, you're supposed to turn your smartphone off, only use email for school business or internet for school research, other than, you know, no social networking, no Netflix, you know, just wandering off. And I had a student who lasted 3 hours. That was her experience. Like, she had to turn her phone back on in 3 hours. And the thing that I found so fascinating was, you know, being in an urban campus, the use of elevators to just make the place function. And for her, that 90 seconds in an elevator, what do you do when you're in an enclosed space with strangers without a smartphone? How do you allow yourself to be subjected to that radical boredom or awkwardness of humanity in a space, let alone, I guess, the outside environment, the world? And I don't know, that's doing something to us, certainly. And yeah, routine is also a thing that is, I feel you, comforting and profoundly stifling.
There's just a middle ground to it. Yeah. As is everything. Like, yeah. Nothing. That's a whole other podcast, man.
Yeah.
The force of the binary of everything.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It's a dialectic, it's not a binary.
Right.
See what I did there?
I did. In regards to technology, on a side note, I dumped water down the back of my TV this morning, so...
Oh.
The summer just got a little bit more interesting.
Oh, no.
So, yeah. See where that goes.
Oh, man. But Netflix, man. No, just
right? Kidding. I was just last night, I was like, I'm getting Netflix back because I saw that they had The Last Jedi on there now. And I haven't seen it yet.
No, you're gonna have to get your space pirate movie somewhere else. In some other form.
Right. So, yeah.
Well, But can I talk about one thing that I find interesting as you're describing the film, and also I think I'm thinking about the record that I actually listened to. I prepped for this podcast. I put that tape in and listened to it this morning. I think the way that you combine, these theoretical philosophical principles and symbolic representation and the use of abstraction and metaphor is really interesting to me. Because, you know what I mean? That there are obviously layers of thought, but I think there are also layers of thought for people to think their way into. And the use of atmosphere and environment. Again, as I was listening to the... See, I'm not going to edit that out either. I punched my music stand. that's going to be there. Probably clip the mic. Probably somebody who's listening to this on earbuds. 10% deafer right now. Sorry, Ryan. But, hey, you know, it's the world. And the way that you do that, and could you talk about that creative process a little bit? Because I think that's really compelling and, you know, and especially, yeah, the use of, the record, though, doesn't have a lot of effects on it, does it? I mean, it's all...
No, there's...
But there's field recordings, right?
Right. There's field recordings, there's some manipulation... but it, like, that record initially, when I started to process what I wanted to do, I didn't want to have any kind of electronic, like any kind of, amplification or anything in it. And it is very minimal, in that respect. There's a little bit of electric guitar in it, but most of it is just acoustic guitar.
Field recordings.
I used like a aluminum water bottle as a percussive instrument. A few different harmonicas, an accordion, bowed banjo, like, yeah.
And that has a concept too, right?
The fact that I didn't want to use
him. No, that there was an idea behind the kitchen, the idea of the kitchen window.
Right. Yes. That's that concept. I've been playing with that concept since my senior synthesis in college, where I was tasked with just creating really any kind of media that I wanted to. And at the time, I was kind of obsessed with independent rom-com and post-apocalyptic literature and film.
Oh, that can make sense.
And
two zeitgeists of the day, yeah.
And I wanted to write... It started, I almost wrote a play, and then I was really lazy at that point in my life, and I was like, yeah, I'm not writing a play. So I decided to just write a short story. And one of the concepts that was in that was this relationship between this couple who are just having a mundane day in their own kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the last day of the earth, but they don't know that.
Mm.
And they're like kind of stuck in this idea of routine, and they're not speaking to each other. And to me, in that story, this kitchen window was like this beacon of light. Like, it's this, the only bit of life in this room.
Mm.
You know? And the song, the track, The Kitchen Window, the last track on the tape, I imagined that track as being something that played while somebody was looking out the kitchen window and experiencing that, everything that's happening outside. So that's how that kind of happened. A lot of interwoven things over, like, many years. It's kind of confusing, but...
No, I think it is, but I think it's interesting is that I think, you know, you have this really interesting thought process that things take years, which is something not most people are into these days.
Right.
With their creative projects, right? Things take years, and that you have... Yeah, layers of thought, layers of symbolic meaning, layers of abstraction, layers of... I don't call it cognitive dissonance, but maybe there is, you know, of, like, this need to figure out, or this need to, with anything... What's that line I use with my students sometimes? How do you get into the world of... How do you make sense of the world of? What are the rules of the world of a particular text? Right. And it seems like you're playing with that. My other question is then, because you're saying, you know, so you have a poem that's a film, and you had a thesis short story that's an album now. What does it mean for you? Because I think about this too, because I work in a couple different mediums. To switch mediums, is there, you know, did you also find that there are just things you could do with sound that you can't do with words, and that you could do with images that maybe, images and music and words together that words alone, you know, and the way that things maybe find their own form? Like, how does that work for you? How is that evolutionary process working?
So there's a couple different, like, I have a couple different answers
for this. Good, question. Good, good. We have time.
Like, in the way that, if when you asked me that question, part of me was like, this question is kind of like asking me to define art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, like, I personally view everything, like, everything that we do as art. Like, even the most mundane thing has, like, an art to it. And so I try not, when it comes to, like, these specific mediums, like art and writing and music, like, as much as I would like to separate them all into their own different microcosm,
mm-hmm.
they're all a moving part of me that's constantly just kind of going.
Mm.
And so it's kind of whatever happens, happens.
That's really cool.
You know, as far as the album Semiotics, that, what the question that you asked me is really important to this, because that whole project, I mean, the study of nonverbal communication,
yeah,
is all, it's completely instrumental.
Yeah.
There are some ideas that are created through the titles of the pieces, but the whole experience is born out of my inability to communicate successfully.
Mm. Mm.
So when that whole thing started, it was probably in the winter of 2015, moving over into 2016, I guess. And I was like really emotionally torn, like, pretty bad, and, like, drinking a lot and abusing drugs, and I didn't really do anything. I went to work, and I would come home and either get really fucked up and go to sleep and go to work the next day, or I would come home from work eat a bunch of food, smoke some weed, and just like lay in bed and mm-hmm. watch things until I fell asleep and then got up. But like, I would never really leave my bedroom, and I wouldn't like try to talk to people. Like, I would eat in bed, and I would like try to like do work in bed, and I just became very reclusive, and it was really difficult for me to do anything. The only thing that I was really able to do comfortably was go to the grocery store. And I had this really bad dream, and it was really vivid, and I woke up and I felt ill from it. And for some reason I decided to smoke some weed, probably to try to make myself go back to sleep or something. But I picked up this guitar and I dropped the tuning to drop D and put the capo on the third fret, which moved it into F. And I just started to play a variation of the first track on the cassette. And it just kind of like kept building, and I would just keep playing it, and I didn't know what it was or what it meant. It kind of felt like classical.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it absolutely does.
Know,
yeah,
like classical music for the 21st century.
Yeah, know, absolutely, like, it does. Yeah.
And so that's really kind of where that came from. It was like everything that I wanted to say to a person, but was unable to. You know? And then the songs just kind of kept building off of that same piece, of that same concept. Like, they're all in the same key.
Yeah.
They all focus on similar themes in like the notes, and the whole thing is really just me. It's everything that I wanted to say but couldn't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it is an emotional experience, because there are definitely aspects of that piece of art that are like, it's not all one experience, it's not all one emotion, it's not all sadness.
Yeah,
you know, there are parts of it that are like, to me it's like in sadness kind of an epiphany. But it's not like you hit the epiphany and then you stay up there. Like, it just kind of comes back down, you know?
Yeah.
And there is, there's some anger in there, for sure. But yeah,
that's awesome, man. But you're right. I see what, you know, thinking about listening to it again this morning, you know, yeah, the idea of epiphany. But you know, it makes me think about both these things. Have me, you know, maybe this is because it's all I ever think about is life under the late capitalism or late industrialization or whatever, where, yeah, we have these, we have routine, we have mechanization. I think in our own particular way, we are sort of mechanized, or we are expected to be the same thing, you know, all the time. And that's to get too Foucauldian, but you think there's even, you know, there are power dynamics in the power from below that we embody in ourselves, the things that we do to sort of fit in or to get through any given day. And I certainly had experiences, you know, times like that in my life where it was just like, well, I have to go to work, but when I'm not at work, life is not, you know, and that, and I think that's the reality for, like, how many people,
right?
You know, is that's it.
Yeah. And at the same time, something that you just said about, you know, wanting to, was it wanting to stay the same?
Or I think just to kind of get along or to be, you know, industrialized or find comfort.
Right.
You know.
And so coming from a place where you, like, acknowledge that, like, no, I don't want to be that. Like, I don't want, and saying, like, I'm not the same person that I was.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not the same person that I was yesterday.
Yeah. Which is hard for people to accept, I think.
Right. And I accept it, but at the same, I accept it for myself.
Yeah.
But I have a difficult time accepting it for other people.
Yeah.
You know, especially people that are closest to me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I always give this speech the Friday before Thanksgiving break. Because where I teach it, there's no fall break, so they, you know, parents drop people off in August, and then people go home in November. And I say to some people, and I've gotten emails from students like, damn it, you were right, but thanks for warning me, how traumatic that freshman year Thanksgiving break can be. Because, and I'll say, what's really weird is people expect you're the same person that they dropped off in August, or worse, because it's Thanksgiving, that graduation party in June, and you're not that person anymore, and you realize you'll never be that person again, and home becomes home in quotation marks. And I think that certainly happens to people too. It weirds me out when people who maybe I knew 20 years ago expect, I mean, I'm still the same guy, but I'm better at it, I think, right. You know, or whatever, and they expect that person from the 90s.
Right. And some people do get caught up in, yeah, that, you know?
Yeah. But life doesn't allow that.
No.
I mean, you know, it's the way that we are all trapped in time.
Yeah. It definitely doesn't work if you want to grow.
Yeah. And also not wanting to grow also doesn't work.
Right.
Right. Which is also terrifying, I think, you know.
Right.
There's a whole Eric Frommian thing about necrophilia in there, but... Well, for him, he takes necrophilia not as, like, I want to go to the morgue and hook up, you know, but it is the love of things that are certain, the love of death. Machines are dead. The past is dead. It is certain. You can go into it if you want. Because you already... I mean, he said that's, you know, for him, like, nostalgia is a low-key form of mental illness. In that, well... You're kind of pursuing death. Like, the past is very safe because we know how it turned out. The future is utterly terrifying. And so for him, he said the opposite is a sort of biophilia, is the love of life, the love of evolution, the love of change, and embracing life as a possession, as an experience, not as a possession. People who don't want to change, you know, it's a possession. I have this. I have this body. I have these capacities. I have these experiences. And being open to anything else is, for him, a love of death. So,
right.
So what you're really talking about is biophilia. The love of life.
I guess so, yeah.
even if it does come from a negative place, I mean, that's still...
Right.
You know, or a painful place, you know.
Yeah. For sure.
So let's see. So how do we experience these things, I guess? So you have a premiere of the film The Dialectics of Falling In and Out of Love is coming up on July 28th. That's Saturday, July 28th, 2018. The internet's forever, so I gotta say the 2018.
Right.
People show up July 28th, 2019, and be like, what the fuck, man? You don't want that.
Yeah.
So it's at the Irma Freeman Center for the Imagination.
Yeah.
Which is on Penn Avenue in Garfield. It's at 7 p.m., 72818 at 7 p.m., the Irma Freeman Center for the Imagination in Garfield on Penn Avenue. I don't remember the address. But there will be a link.
Yes.
There will be a link in the podcast post on the website. Oh, and it's $5. It's $5.
Yeah.
$5. You want to see this movie? It's $5. Yeah,
just try to cover the cost of the space.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll be there. And the album is on no conflict of interest on my part until thequasar.bandcamp.com is where you can find Semiotic Stuff Volume 1, The Kitchen Window. And also, I guess I'll put up, you have Instagram, you have an old Bandcamp page with your old folk punk stuff. And now it's time for the bottom five.
Bottom five.
Have you ever listened to this podcast before? I forgot to ask before. Man. Oh, okay. So the bottom five is a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. We always end with the bottom five.
Sounds great.
Yeah. So question one, the question everybody gets their first time. If reincarnation is real and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, so basically we're talking virus or germ, what kind of disease or illness would you be?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Like, if you just, human is the hierarchy, and then you just go back down to single cell and work your way back up again.
Oh.
Or you just really fucked up, and then it's like, no, you don't even get to be a monkey. You got to go all the way back to single cell. And
becoming a virus.
Yeah, virus, a disease or illness. What disease or illness would you be?
Probably the common cold.
God, that's a good one. It's classic. It's timeless.
That's something with the least suffering.
Yeah, I like that.
Even though like
gets around.
As the common cold, I'm not going to suffer.
Yeah, this is true.
But the sufferer could suffer the very least. I would like to hear what some other people have said about that.
There's been a wide range. STDs are popular.
Oh.
Cold, flu. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gut bacteria. We had a couple gut bacteria choices.
Yeah, because you can good gut
bacteria. Yeah, it's good, good.
Yeah, why didn't I say that? I'd be a probiotic.
Probiotic? Oh, too late. Too late. All right, question two. It's not really a question, it's a prompt. Tell me a happy but somewhat unremarkable memory of your childhood.
Oh, man.
Happy but unremarkable. So not like we went to fucking Disney World, but like that time it rained and you made cookies.
Right. It's not a lot of good memories back there. I have this vague... very vague memory of playing baseball with like a big orange wiffle bat, with a softball sized ball. And I remember my parents were still like together, and I can just see the grass being very green, and it's probably only like 1994,
yeah,
and I'm only 4 years old, but like, and maybe I didn't know what happiness meant then, but I look back at that sometimes and I just think about that one moment.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like things were all right then.
Yeah.
Like, it in the larger spectrum of things. Like, not in my life, but, like, in the world.
Yeah.
Like, the innocence and how the grass was very green and now it's brown.
Yes. And stained with dog piss. Question three, and this is the Christopher Hitchens question. Of the living villains of history, whose obituary would you most like to write? If you could write somebody's obituary.
Villains.
Of living villains.
Living.
Living Right now, whose obituary do you look forward to not only reading perhaps in the future, but perhaps the opportunity to write it?
The cop-out, I wouldn't even want to waste my time on.
Okay.
You know.
See, you can go like
on
sort
of. Pumpkin Man.
Yeah, no, Pumpkin Man's done.
Martin Scorsese.
Oh, that's a good one.
That's
a Faustian one.
Yeah, like, I fucking hate his face. Like, he is such a smug prick.
Yeah.
That, like, I would love to read or write his obituary.
Now, would it be about, like, what turned him into that? Or was it just, like, all of the... Or would it just be a litany of all of the shitbag moments? That, like, the things that happened to him, you know, as he's rotting in a federal prison... You know, wouldn't that be amazing? Like, how he felt when his house got raided. When they took away his Wu-Tang album.
Yeah.
You know, wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
Pure Schadenfreude. All right.
Right.
Question four. This is another textual question, I guess. So, if we're living in a dystopian future, like different than the one that the Pumpkin Man has brought us, and the only books to survive would be those bound in human skin. So only human skin books live. Everything else just gets mulched. Would you, say, sacrifice your being so that a book could survive into future generations? And if so, what book would you donate your skin for? And you can't say the Bible, the Quran, or the complete works of Shakespeare. People fucking did those. Somebody did those.
Yeah, somebody already...
Like, the first three people in line. That's the first three people in line at the tannery.
Right.
Somebody's saving the Bible, somebody's saving the Quran, somebody's saving the complete works of Shakespeare. Those are good. Would you march yourself off into the tannery with a volume tucked under your shoulder?
So this is kind of like... Like, it's not like you're going to die of old age. And
No, they're probably going to smash your head between two cinder blocks and
they want that
start the skinning process.
Primo skin.
Yes, they want that good skin. Maybe a little starvation, you know, if you remember Silence of the Lambs. Mm-hmm. Maybe they want to loosen the skin up a little bit. But,
right.
But probably once you go to the tannery, your days are definitely numbered.
You know.
Or hours.
This would have made the Book of Eli much more interesting. you know, no.
No? Wouldn't do it?
No. And because maybe it's not, at that point, it's not that important. You know, and maybe some things are just better left behind.
Biophilia.
You know?
Biophilia. There you go. We're moving on. The books are gone. All right. Last question. Another metaphysical question. If there is a hell and you end up there, name one celebrity that you expect / hope to meet there.
Who would I want to see there?
Yeah, who would you want to see in hell? This is also maybe the Mark Twain Letters from the Earth question.
Right.
You know, maybe the more interesting, you know, heaven for the climate, hell for the company.
Right. There's so many different ways to answer that question. Like, there's just...
Well, there's this sort of schadenfreude, like, I'm glad you're suffering. Or, yay, we get to hang out.
Yeah, like, what pops into my head immediately is not, like, really, I'm glad you're suffering. It's just like, really, who are the two people that popped into my head? I don't really even want to say. For some reason, the first person that popped into my head was Ernest Hemingway.
No, that makes sense.
You know?
No, that makes sense.
But like, not, like, I wasn't like, yeah, he's fucking suffering, but I just wanted to be like, why are you such an asshole? You know.
So I had this Hemingway story. So I And it's in a way the class in college that inspired this question, because we read Letters from the Earth too. The gen ed requirement was, at the time, the old gen ed requirement, some people just had to take a random upper level English course. And so you had these, like, we didn't have the word dude bros then, but these dude bros were just in the class and just did not fucking say anything. And then for 1 week we did Old Man in the Sea. And it was amazing. Like, I heard voices. Like, these people, oh, wow, these people have voices. Holy shit. And it was the weirdest, like, thing for that 1 week. Like, that book made sense to right. people. To, like, toxic masculinity in our midst. There it was! And they were rocking. They were like, yeah, you know, you'll catch the big fish and then you'll reel it in and then, you know, no one will give a fuck.
Yeah, that story was so fucking stupid. Like, dude. Let's go back. Like, go back home. What are you doing? You know? And, like, I don't know. Like, I do appreciate some of Hemingway's writing.
I mean, the way that in that book, speaking of that book, you know, that you get the sense of the ocean and the rhythm is amazing. But to, like... See, we have this conversation in this household about Eddie Van Halen. Like, you have this gift to do this thing, and that's what you did with it.
Right.
Not that I don't like a couple Van Halen songs, you know, and they're good when you're really drunk, but that's what you did.
Right, that's it. That's what you went for.
Yeah.
I could say that about so many things. I think I'd also like to see Nietzsche there. And also ask him, why are you such a fucking asshole?
Yeah, no. Speaking of toxic masculinity, yeah. That one woman didn't want to sleep with you, and you're fucked? You're like, really, dude? Like, get over it.
Right.
Get over it. No, that's a good one. That's a good party pack hell combo. And you would think those two people, like, the dickhead inertia, because dickheads find each other, you know, in closed communities, and they would just find each other.
Right.
And they would be at the same table.
Yeah, getting... plastered.
Yeah. Perfect. Well, on that happy note, I think that's about it. Again, film premiere of The Dialectics of Falling In and Out of Love. 7 p.m., 728-18, Irma Freeman Center for the Imagination. Hey, you gotta pay for the space. Bring $5. It'll be an interesting time. Speaking of interesting times, you can also find the album Semiotics Volume 1, The Kitchen Window, on UntilTheQuasarCassettes.com or UntilTheQuasar.bandcamp.com. We don't have our own website.
A little ahead of yourself.
A little ahead of ourselves, eventually. And, of course, links will be on our website. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it'll be about something. I mean, right? Somebody will be here, and we'll talk. Our homepage, where you can find old and new episodes, is gonnadiepodcast.com. We're also on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Podcast Addict, Google Play Podcasts, and Mixcloud, because why not? Follow us on Twitter at gonnadiepodcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Thanks again, Andrew.
Thank you.
Later, meets.